Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the No Silicast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever so slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, September 28th, 2008, and this is show number 171. I hope you have some time carved out for the show today because I think it's going to be a long one. We did Chit Chat Across the Pond live this week on ustream.tv/nosilicast, and we got on a topic near and dear to Bart's heart, how to choose a hosting company for your website. So the discussion got lively when I didn't quite agree with him 100%. The chat room encouraged us to keep the whole thing in and not cut it back, so the whole thing's in there. Well, you know what's really fun about having your own show? You can talk about anything you want. This is supposed to be a tech show, but you might have noticed that I like a good laugh any day of the week. Well, silliness just, I don't know, it just makes me so very happy. Last week on the Bonnie Hunt Show, she had as her guest Cloris Leachman. You might be too young to know who she is, but just go look her up if you haven't ever heard of her. Anyway, Cloris was absolutely hysterical on the show. She's 82 years old now, and she's so playful, so silly. She's just a complete knucklehead. I guarantee if you go watch this, you will absolutely enjoy it. There's no point during the conversation that Bonnie Hunt is ever in the least little bit in charge of the conversation. I embedded the video over on podfeet.com. Take a break when you're done listening to the show, of course, and treat yourself to a good laugh. All right, let's talk about tech now. Well, there's a tech story I've been meaning to tell forever, since like the middle of this summer. See, our good friends Ileana and Mike got married in a beautiful ceremony down on the beach, surrounded by friends and family. It was so romantic. The sun was setting with gentle rays, casting a lovely red glow across their faces as the minister began the ceremony. Mike took Ileana's hands in his and quietly pronounced his love for her, and there wasn't a dry eye in the crowd. Then it was Ileana's turn, and she took out her iPhone and read her vows from it. It was hilarious. I just loved it. I didn't think you guys would believe me, so I took pictures and I even got her permission to post them on the blog. She did explain later what had happened. See, she had typed her vows out on her MacBook, but she couldn't get her printer to work, so she emailed them to her iPhone. I thought it was an ingenious solution and, oh, so very, very geeky. Well, speaking of love, here's a really quick random little story. The other day, I'm standing out in front of my gym, and I'm finishing up an email on my iPhone. And a woman I've seen in the gym before, but I don't know her very well, comes up close to me and she says, "Are you in love?" I look at her kind of oddly, of course, and she says, "I've been telling all my friends ever since I got my iPhone, I've fallen in love again." And she wandered dreamily away. I didn't have the heart to tell her I'd been silently cursing my iPhone while I was trying to type something and it kept auto-correcting me incorrectly. And while I was writing the email, I was also listening to Buzz Out Loud, where they were describing the latest in the long list of applications Apple has banned from the store. But hey, she's in love again. Well, after the discussion about backups, about 25 people sent me emails telling me that you can boot from an external USB drive now. It appears that I'm perhaps the last person on Earth to find out about this. Thanks to everyone who wrote, it was great news to find that out. On other boot news, Bart and I got a great email this week from listener Pam. Here's what she wrote. "Thank you, Allison, and thank you, Bart. I listened to the podcast a couple of days ago and thought Bart was so smart to use target disk mode to help him solve the problem of the shredding optical drive. What a great idea. And sure enough, as fate would have it, today my brother brought over my sister-in-law's MacBook because the optical drive would not accept the Leopard install disk or any other disk. It just spat them all out. What a coincidence. What a great setup to make my brother think I'm a genius and to think the Mac is wonderful. My brother also said this could not have been done with a PC. I put my Intel iMac into a target disk mode with the Leopard install disk and the optical drive. I connected the FireWire cable. The MacBook instantly picked up the target drive image from my iMac, and a finder window with a Leopard install icon appeared on the MacBook. We ran the install, and it was successful. This is such an obvious technique, but I doubt I would have thought of it myself. I'm so lucky I just listened to the podcast, and it was fresh in my mind. Thank you. My sister-in-law thanks you. Love the podcast. I've been listening forever, and I've always meant to write. Now I just had to, so I could thank you." Well, I got to tell you, Bart and I just love this letter. You know, we both prattle on about whatever entertains us in Geekland. So it's wonderful when this all actually ends up helping someone. It's a great thrill whenever I get an email from any of you. It never gets old to hear some thanks and a description of how you get to use what we teach. I have to tell you, I had a very similar experience once to Pam's. So my friend Melissa calls me from Virginia, 3,000 miles away from where I live, right? And she says, "Allison, Harvey can't get on the internet. Fix it." And she hands Harvey the phone. And I'm thinking, okay, wait a minute. You're 3,000 miles away and you're on a PC and I'm supposed to fix this. How am I possibly going to figure this out? And then I remembered Leo Laporte always saying, turn off Norton Internet Security. So I said, "Hey, so have you got Norton Internet Security running on there, Harvey?" And he says, "Why, yes, I do." And I said, "Well, turn it off." And he said, "Oh my gosh, it worked. Allison, you're a genius. You're amazing." I just got really, really lucky that day. It's kind of fun after a while. I guess it's like immersion therapy. You hear enough stuff somewhere along the lines, it just comes in helpful. You know, I'm a huge fan of Screen Steps. By the way, I actually contacted them to ask them if I could advertise for them because I couldn't stop myself from talking about their tool anyway. I keep showing it to people, and I would say that probably around 9 out of 10 people I show it to actually go out and buy it right away. If you find yourself helping other people learn how to do things, maybe you just help them do a few steps on the computer, or maybe you explain entire software manuals. Screen Steps will make that process so much faster and easier. Imagine not fighting or formatting or page breaks or even saying Microsoft Word when you're trying to write up some steps on how to do something on a Mac or Windows. It's such a relief not to fight with Word and that stupid little dog for wrapping text around an image. I never know what to do with that dog. I'm telling you, I don't even cry when I do documentation on Screen Steps. I cried a lot with Microsoft Word. Well, anyway, I keep running into weird ways that Screen Steps really helps me. I want to emphasize that it's not just a screen snapshot tool, but darn it, it's got a really, really good screen capture tool in it. Take last week. I was working on Windows, and I needed to take a shot of the QuickTime Inspector window. This is a window that you can open when you're in QuickTime, and if you go under Window and pull down to Inspector, or Movie Inspector, or something like that, it'll tell you the dimensions, how it's encoded, all kinds of interesting data about it. I needed to get a screen snapshot of that on Windows. I dare you to find a tool that can take a picture of it on Windows. On the Mac, the Inspector window stays up when you navigate away from it, so Sketch will do the trick, and all kinds of other ways of doing screen snapshots will. But on Windows, as soon as you move focus off the window, it goes solid gray. No worry for Screen Steps, because it has a timed screen capture tool. Set it for 4 seconds, 6 seconds, whatever you think it's going to take. You go back to QuickTime, click on the Inspector window, and then you wait for Screen Steps to count down to zero. When it gets to zero, it freezes whatever's going on in the frame. You know, like one of those movies where they stop time and they run around and move the cheeseburger away from the guy's mouth while they've stopped time just to mess with him. Well, anyway, the QuickTime window will stay in focus while you stop time. You can take the snapshot, and as soon as you're done, time travels on and the guy realizes he can't find his cheeseburger. Well, anyway, you get my point. You get a screen snapshot of the tool. If you'd like to give Screen Steps a try, click the big logo in the sidebar on podfeet.com and download the free 30-day trial. Be sure to watch their videos on how to use it. They're really, really quick, but they make a huge difference in understanding what the tool is and how you can use it. When you decide you can resist no longer and you're going to buy it, be sure to use the NOSILLA coupon code to get 25% off. That's NOSILLA in all capital letters.
Dumb.
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 Dumb questions.
Dumb questions.
Dumb questions.
What is?
How come I always have to?
It's time for Dumb Question Corner.
Well, Martin from Germany will never have a true dumb question. He simply does not know how to play this game. In case you're doubting me right now, let me read you his latest dumb question that he sent. I've set my keychain to require an additional password to unlock. Just because, well, I like the more sensitive stuff being protected by a password that's a no-go for anyone to remember while staring at my keyboard. So it has like 40 or 50 characters with lots of special characters in there. But as some applications, like OmniFocus, require the keychain unlocked whenever they start up, and others just steal your focus while booting up, It easily happens that the window with a password question, that counts for any window that asks for administration access as well, loses focus while you're typing. Even worse, there seems to be no way you can use any keyboard shortcut to focus that window again. It drives me nuts. They're not Apple tabbable, nor can you focus them using Quicksilver or something like that. Is there a key combo I'm missing out? So I answered him, gee, I don't know. Let's go ask Bart, who answered that he hadn't a clue either. Well, this clearly does not qualify in the spirit of Dumb Question Corner. I decided to read it on the off chance that someone could steer Martin in the correct direction. But Martin isn't just a taker, he's a giver too. One of the great things I've learned about the NoSillaCast listeners is that we have the full range from noobs wanting to learn from and all the way up to uber geeks. So perhaps a few of you will be able to use the information he provides. I have to confess, it's beyond my technical depth, but it's good to stretch ourselves once in a while, right? Here's what else he said. I've just listened about your and Bart discussing about iPhoto again, and I wanted to share two plugins with the two of you. Dustin.li, aka FF Exporter, which is a free Flickr exporter plugin for iPhoto, which I use to upload my files. Okay, that wasn't Martin's really geeky part. That's a great suggestion, which many people sent me, but actually kind of missed the point that we had no trouble exporting photos. It was videos we were having trouble exporting from iPhoto. Here's when Martin slips off the geek edge. And for the more geeky amongst us, there is n8gray.org/code/script export, also known as script export, which will allow you to run shell scripts on images from iPhoto, which therefore is quite like having every functionality on your hand as long as you're able to program shell scripts. Yet I must admit that it was nearly a year ago that I last ran script export, and I'm not quite sure the link is correct and not some malware. Oh well, I've warned you. Okay, you guys scared of Martin yet? Listen on. And now finally, there are two things that may be interesting for more geeky among your listeners. First of all, I want to throw a cross-platform terminal-based Twitter client in the row. floodgap.com/software/TTYTTER, also known as Twitter? I don't know, it's TTYTTER. Anyway, he says, for me, it's the best Twitter client so far, but it's probably not for everyone. And he sent us a screenshot of it. It's geeky. Really, really geeky. So thanks, Martin. I'll be sure to let you know if we get any answers to your questions. It looks like possibly Gita in the chat room might have come up with one of the answers here. We'll have to talk about it after the show. I'll have to go back and read the notes and see what she came out with. And thanks for the geekiest Twitter client there is. Well, Pat wrote in with a dumb question, a real one. She knows how to play the game. I've decided the definition of a good dumb question might be that if I know the answer. Anyway, let's hear her question. Hi, Allison. Here's one that people are always asking me, and I don't really know the answer. When you open Disk Utility, it shows all of your drives on the left, and it lists them twice, once as a size and make, and under that with the name of the drive. When you select a drive in order to have Disk Utility perform some action like verify or erase, does it matter which one of the two you pick? Well, Pat, this is a great question because it's not really obvious why there are two versions of your drive up there, but this is a good chance to learn some stuff that I think will probably help you in the future. The one showing the size and make is the physical hardware. You'll notice it says something like Samsung or, you know, whatever the manufacturer of your hard drive is, Seagate or whatever, while the one with the name is actually the partition. Now, normally you would probably only have one partition, but in many cases now, people like to partition one physical drive into two or more partitions. An example might be you might want to separate your operating system from your files so it's easier to blow away if you need to reinstall the OS for some reason. When you do a partition, you'll end up with two of those name drives underneath the actual hardware drive. If you click on the physical drive, you'll notice that you get one more tab than you do if you choose the name, and that tab is partition. Check that tab out, and you'll notice that on the left side, you'll see your partition name. If you had no data on that drive, you could click the plus sign at the bottom and add partitions, naming them over on the right. If you did have more than one partition, you could click on it and perform an operation like verify disk permissions, and would only perform that operation on a single partition. If you chose the physical drive, it would perform that operation on the entire drive. I hope that makes sense to everyone. I hope that helps you answer the questions that you have, Pat. I really appreciate your question. You can also read Pat's two blogs if you like, one on Macs called MacMainer.com, that's M-A-I-N-E-R, and then she's got one about her dogs at MWPBooks.com. Well, as you know, Willie has been a great contributor to the show over the past 6 months, and for once, I was able to help him, but not in a technical way. But of course, along the way, he taught me a new tool. Here's the problem he had. He's taking Spanish for the first time in high school. He asked me if I knew anyone fluent. Well, it turns out my daughter is minoring in Spanish in college, so I hoped I could help him. He had a series of sentences to translate, and he knew all but one of them. Now, he could have emailed me the sentences and then me email them to my daughter, or maybe he could have chatted them to me and again I forwarded them on to her, but he had an even cooler trick up his sleeve. He used clip.com, and that's spelled C-L-1-P.com. This is one of the weirdest web things I've ever seen, and I still don't think I have my brain completely wrapped around it. Willie describes it as saying CL1P.com. I'll just call it clip.com because it's easy to say. He says clip.com is the internet clipboard, and it allows you to copy and paste between computers in three easy steps. Enter any URL that starts with clip.com, like CL1P.com/Spanish. That would work. Paste any text you want into the window that comes up. In this example, he pasted in the Spanish and English sentences. On any other computer, enter the URL as in step one. So, picture this. Lindsay goes to clip.com/Spanish, and she sees what Willie has pasted in. He had a series of question marks where the sentence he needed help with should go. Lindsay simply replaced those question marks with the correct Spanish translation and hit save on the page. Willie refreshes it, and it shows up in his browser now. It's sort of like a wiki, but it's kind of transient. These URLs disappear after a while. And it's very live feeling, like you don't hit edit and then save. You just start typing on the page and hit save. I created one for you to play with at clip.com/nosillacast. And again, that's CL1P.com/nosillacast. I want you guys to type in anything you want, as long as you play nice, and then hit save. It's wild. You can also restrict access with a password if you want, which might be handy sometime. Check it all out over at cl1p.com, and thanks to Willie for yet another tip. This just in, hot off the presses. While I was doing that review, Willie was in the chat room watching the live show, and he said, oh, heck, clip.com is old news. You want to go to clip.net now, cl1p.net. That's where you want to go. It turns out that auto-saves, so you don't even have to hit that pesky save button. And it's even got all kinds of options and stuff down the side. It's got, you'd insert pictures, all kinds of things. I am so going to play with this. By the way, it does say the clip expires in 7 days. Yet another reason you should come over to the live chat and watch the show being created at ustream.tv/nosillacast at about around 5 o'clock GMT minus 8 is when I usually get started. I was a little late today, but I had lots of good excuses. Well, Donald Burr is back with a quick review of caffeine.
Hi, Donald Burr of Otakuno Podcast and Voices of Aaron Podcast. Here with yet another quick tip. This one's mostly for you laptop owners out there. That is iBooks, MacBooks, MacBook Pros, PowerBooks. Tell me, has this ever happened to you? You're sitting there watching a video. Maybe it's a YouTube video of your grandson's first piano recital or something. Maybe it's the latest DVD you got from Blockbuster or Netflix. Or maybe it's something you bought off of iTunes. When all of a sudden, your screen dims. Yes, usually this happens at the worst possible moment, like when your son is making that crucial catch in the baseball game, or the hero is about to swoop in and save the day in the movie. On laptops, OS X loves to dim the screen after a short period of inactivity, presumably to save power. The thing that really gets me, though, is it does this even if you're plugged into the AC wall outlet. And it does this even if you have the screen set to never dim in the energy saver control panel. What's the deal with that? What do you do about it? Well, why not give it some caffeine? No, I don't mean pouring that Quinty Venti latte down your keyboard or DVD drive slot. Please, for the love of God, don't. I mean to install this little program called Caffeine into your applications folder. It's very small, takes up almost no resources. All it does is just puts a little icon of a coffee cup in your mini bar. Click on it, and the coffee cup fills up with coffee, and lovely waves of steam start pouring out the top of it. More importantly, clicking this icon prevents your Mac from dimming the screen, period, or going to sleep. So you can watch that movie without those annoying screen-dimming interruptions. All right, maybe you're not trying to watch a movie. Maybe you're, I don't know, trying to read a long Wikipedia article or something. It's the same thing. I mean, who wants to be interrupted reading a long Wikipedia article by your screen suddenly dimming on you? Isn't that annoying? Well, installing Caffeine will solve the problem for you. It's, like I said, it's small, takes up almost no resources, and the best part is, it is free. You can download it from the URL that I'm sure Allison will put in the show notes. Anyways, hope you enjoyed this little tip, and we now return you to your regularly scheduled NozzleCast.
Well, I've used Caffeine for ages, Donald, and I just love it. I am so with you on this. I've been using it for so long that my version of Caffeine only showed 3 Z's, no coffee cup with steaming coffee. I thought I must upgrade. I did the upgrade, and I found my version was 2 years old. The best news is that it works exactly like it did before. As Tim Verporten of the Mac ReviewCast likes to say, it's an app that does one thing and does it well. Donald forgot one thing in his review, in his haste to get it under 5 minutes, I bet. He asked me to remind you that he said Caffeine also prevents the screensaver from activating, which is another extremely annoying thing that tends to happen a lot when you're sitting at your Mac watching videos or reading long blog or web pages and documents. Thanks for the tip, Donald. Really appreciate it. Well, how long have you been putting off maintenance on your Honda or Acura? Are you treating auto maintenance like teeth cleaning? The good news is that it doesn't have to be painful. If you call Honda Bob at 562-531-2321 or email him at hdabob@aol.com, I promise he will not poke you with a sharp instrument and then frown at you disapprovingly that your gums are bleeding. What do they think's going to happen when they stick you with a sharp instrument? Well, anyway, there is no pain when Bob comes to your house. He charges a fair price, he knows what he's doing, and you never leave the comfort of your own home. And guess what? Your car will last longer if you let him change all those sticky fluids and belts and stuff. Imagine getting higher resale value on your Honda or Acura just because you let Honda Bob come visit once in a while. Oh, one more thing. You do have to live in the LA or Orange County areas to use his services. Sorry to everyone else. H.A. Bob's mobile service is not affiliated with Honda, Acura, or Honda Worldwide. Well, it's time for another exciting episode of Chit Chat Across the Pond with Bart Bouchatz from BartB.ie, or at least it usually is, right, Bart?
Yeah, it's sort of from Bart from the internet in general today because my server packed it in over, well, yesterday. I prodded it a little hard and it went, no, I'm sorry, but I've had enough of being alive and existing and fell over.
Aww,
so I'm in the process of moving from to a new server, basically, that's a little cheaper, a little better. So I'm actually getting a better server for less money, but it's all the way over in Canada. So it's going to take me a while to shift everything over, and I have to fax them over photocopies of stuff to prove that I am who I say I am and stuff. They're quite a thorough company, so it's going to take a few days until all the paperwork's out of the way.
Well, the good news is that made us a reason to talk today, right? We got I think that's going to be one of our topics.
I think that's our main topic, apart from our fruit and vegetables security light section.
Yeah, let me.
Have many people emailed you on the terrible quest of figuring out which is the worst vegetable?
Yes, and so far all votes say that Brussels sprouts are worse than broccoli. I keep getting votes for broccoli as the tastier of the vegetables,
or the less untasty.
No, I actually love it personally.
I tolerate it sometimes because I know it's good for me.
Oh, dear. Well, hey, before we go too far, I did want to say that this is the first ever live recording of Chit Chat Across the Pond over on Ustream.
Yeah, this is kind of weird, having like people watching and stuff, because I can usually pretend that I'm not talking to the whole internet while I'm talking to you, but I can't today because half the internet is in our chat room.
It looks like it. Yeah, it's a packed house today, so that's a lot of fun. Well, we have Kenny Lee to thank for forcing us into this. I had to put on makeup to do audio, well, because I turned on the video, I guess.
Yeah, and in an interesting twist of irony, the only person not in the chat room is Kenny.
Well, the good thing we're recording it for him, I guess.
That's true. At least I hope we are.
All right. So let's go ahead and get started with the show. One of the things you just referred to was Security Lite. So for the listening audience, I keep trying to hold the reins back on too much security talk because I just get depressed. And a lot of it I don't understand, but what we decided we would stick with is what we're going to call Security Lite, which means only things that you can do something about. Like, actively today, this is what you should do in order to protect yourself. If it's just, oh my God, there's this big, bad, horrible thing. Well, if it's a huge, horrible thing like the DNS flaw, maybe. But in general, we're going to try to just keep it to things you can do something about, like turn off this little switch in Safari like we talked about last week.
Yeah, and in this case, it's even easier. When the little updater says, would you like me to update your system? The answer is yes.
Okay, so why don't you give us a quick description of what's wrong and what we're going to fix today?
Okay, well, OS X contains within it Java, the entire Java runtime environment, which is used by some applications. And Apple tweaked Java so that on the Mac, when you open a Java app, it actually looks usually like an OS X app if it's been written properly. So you still get your same Mac-like buttons, even though you're in a Java app, which is actually kind of nice, and it makes Java a lot more friendly.
What's an example of that?
What do I use as Java-based? Eclipse, which is a fantastic IDE I use a lot, and that looks like an OS X app on OS X, and it looks like a Windows app on Windows, because it's well-written Java that would simply take on the appropriate look. I use a couple of other little Java applets and stuff, and they get the roundy buttons with the aqua colors instead of the ugly square gray buttons that Java would normally have. Okay. And that's because Apple have basically re-implemented certain little bits of the Java API to be Mac-like. So that means that the Java we have is not identical to the Java that's out there in general.
Okay, so sounds on like microsystems, a good thing so far.
Yeah, except for the fact that Apple are doing their standard trick, which is ignoring security updates to open source components and being months late in patching them on the Mac. So around about last March, Sun released a big update that fixed loads of nasty, icky bugs, and now Apple have finally got around to letting us have it.
Oh, yikes. So what should come up and what should we do about it?
It's going to ask you to update Java, and you're just going to say yes. Now, be warned, it's a big update. It's 136 megabytes,
ooh,
and it's for Tiger and for Leopard. Yeah, it's a big one. So I think rather than updating it, they're simply replacing it. Would certainly seem to be the case when it's that big.
Yeah, that sounds crazy.
Just to give you an idea of why you should update, now that you're not updated, or maybe you are if you already clicked yes, if you're not updated yet, there's some flaws in Java which would allow anyone basically to run arbitrary code execution. So basically, the bad guys run anything they want in your machine, and all you have to do is visit a website that has a malicious Java applet in it, and hey presto, you're hosed. Which, you know, that's not good. If you browse with something like NoScript and don't turn on Java on anywhere that you don't need it, then you're an awful lot safer. But out of the box, default browsing in Safari or even default Firefox, just visit the wrong web page, fires up a malicious applet, and they have control of your machine. So not good.
Yikes.
Definitely want to update, sooner rather than later.
So I don't know whether mine's come up yet. I do seem to remember being in the middle of something really important and seeing it pop up maybe yesterday. So I promise to go in after the show and do an update.
Yeah, you know, it's an important one, but it's a big one, so take time. Now, if memory serves, it's not one you have to reboot from, I think. Now that I've said that, I'm probably going
to
be wrong.
I think the one I just saw and didn't say yes to was a reboot, and that was why, because I usually don't. I do the ones that don't reboot. I do those immediately.
Now, I have a funny feeling I'm mixing it up with some other updates I've recently done. It probably is a reboot one, so pretend I didn't say that, although we can edit it out because we're live on the chat room.
There you go. Well, I got to tell you, I had to reinstall Firefox on Vista, and that required a reboot on Vista.
What?
And I also don't understand why I had to reinstall Firefox in the first place. Firefox just decided it didn't want to have bookmarks anymore.
Why would you need those?
They were just all gone. Everything out of the menu bar, everything out of the toolbar, out of the favorites or whatever it's called. I mean, they were all gone. One thing was cool, though. I complained about it on Twitter, and Firefox Answers wrote back to me and started asking some questions about things I had in there. So that was kind of fun. Didn't
Excellent.
Fix anything, but they were concerned and curious what might have happened. But my machine was imploding on Thursday anyway, so.
Yeah, good suggestion there from Mark Shepard in the chat room. Use Foxmarks. That way you're bookmarks are synced into the quote-unquote cloud.
Yeah, but I don't want my
work... called the internet.
No, that's not going to work for me because this is a work machine and I'm not going to put my work bookmarks out in the cloud. Not going to do it. Wouldn't be prudent.
No, probably... Well, the chances are they wouldn't work from outside the corporate firewall anyway, so it'd probably be useless information. But I can't imagine corporate IT being entirely pleased with you.
Exactly, which is another reason I don't use Delicious for that. So I thought about it at first, and I was like, ah, I can't do that. So yeah, there's no fixing it. It's a mess. So anyway, that was not the subject of the day. We were going to talk about hosting, and I think I have a little different view, but not good enough to have a full-on argument about it. But we wanted to talk about hosting your website, and a lot of people, especially through the Podcasting on Podcasting series, are curious about, well, how do you pick a hosting service? What do you do? So I think you have some advice for us.
Well, I figured we'd talk about it. I mean, you and I have made different choices for our hosting. We've opted for a different way of doing things, but they're both valid choices. And so I just figured, you know, now that I've managed to blow up my server, now would be a good time to talk about these things because I'm dealing with them at the moment. So I suppose we should probably start with the fact that there's sort of two aspects to hosting your own website. The first thing you have to worry about is your domain name, which is entirely separate from the hosting. So what you're basically doing there is you're paying some company, like GoDaddy or someone, to register the domain on your behalf with the registrar, and also to put your information on their DNS server so that when someone types into their browser www.podfeet.com, that the internet as a whole knows where Podfeet is. And so if you didn't have DNS and if no one was being a DNS server for you, that simply wouldn't work. And you pay GoDaddy a few dollars a year for that privilege. So...
Now
you have, it's, I suppose my main point is that if you, whoever is controlling your domain basically has control over it completely and utterly. And if you don't trust them, you have a problem because they could really do anything with it. So I think it's really important to have a trustworthy domain registrar and preferably one that doesn't have any sort of conflict of interest that might make them keen for you to forget to renew.
Well, also one of the things I look for is I want to separate the hosting, well, I didn't actually do it this time, but it's not a bad idea to separate the hosting from the domain registration. So if you end up with a problem with them, you can actually, from the hosting perspective, you can actually move your domain.
Yeah, I like to keep my domain separate. The hosting is all cheap. Domain registration is all cheap these days. I mean, I don't know what GoDaddy charge, but I'm pretty sure it's quite little.
Right.
What is it, $3 a year or something?
Something like that. Yeah, it's really, really cheap. But
it's
that's why I love all the ads.
More.
I love all the affiliate ads that go, 10% off your next order. It's like, whoa, 30 cents. Woohoo.
Yay.
Awesome.
I can go buy a sweetie, maybe. but I actually pay a little more. I pay, I think it's about €9 a year, which is still very little. But the reason I do that is because I like to be with a company I know and trust. And in this case, I'm with a company that's a few miles down the road, whose headquarters I've visited and whose general manager I've met and know, kind of. And follow on Twitter and can annoy him over Twitter when stuff breaks.
is that for the domain registration or for the hosting?
It used to be both. The company's split in half now, so they used to do both for me, but now they've become two separate companies. But yeah, I like to keep my domains there because they have a pretty good setup. They don't upsell you all the time, which is nice. They don't send any ads your way. When you log into the control panel, the only thing you see is your stuff, which I find fantastic. And I trust them. They have a good service. And in particular, I mean, you don't have this problem in America because .com is a completely open domain area, TLD, top-level domain. Whereas in Ireland, we have a regulated TLD, which means that anyone cannot get a .ie address. You have to justify them and you have to apply for them under certain criteria. And it really helps to have a registrar who knows the system well on your side. Because honestly, if it hadn't been for a registered 365, I would never have gotten bartbouchats.ie. Because the rules used to be that little ordinary people could only get their initials and then a number. So I would have been bb25.ie. Which, quite frankly, sucked. And between myself and Register 365, we found a loophole, which was that you could have the name of your online publication. So I renamed my blog so that it was called Bart Bouchats, and then went, I have an electronic publication, therefore I'm now requesting the name of that publication, .ie. So I got bartbouchats.ie. But there's no way I could have done that without the help of a competent domain registrar. And if there's any sort of problems, Register 365 are really good to me. And I've never had an issue that hasn't been sorted out.
See, so, I don't have a lot of interaction from the registrar perspective. I mean, I gave them some money and they registered my name. And that's pretty, there's not a, there's not a lot of interaction going on there. It's here's a check. And actually, by the way, I think it's more like $10 a year. But I give them a check and then I have that domain. And they send me an email when it's coming up for renewal. And they say, do you want to renew? If you want to renew early, here's 30% off, that kind of thing. That's pretty much all of the interaction I end up having.
Yeah, so something to be aware of with GoDaddy, which I came across recently on Floss Weekly, I think it was, which is a great Leah Laporte show for anyone who's into programming and open source and stuff. But basically, one of the ways GoDaddy are cheaper than pretty much anyone else out there. And the reason they do that is because they don't make all of their money from actually doing the domain registration and stuff. What they do is they wait for you to not pay your domain, and then they auction it off if it's anyway decent, and they can make a few grand from a domain. So it doesn't matter if they sell a load of them for like $3 or whatever. They can make $3,000 off the ones that expire. So what that means is that they have a conflict of interest because it's in their interest for you not to renew.
But
so they're
almost waiting
on you to fail.
No, no, no. That's not true, Bart. That's not. I mean, it may be true they have an interest in that, but they send me notices 3 months in advance, 2 months in advance, 1 month in advance telling me to renew. That's not somebody who's trying to get me not to renew. That's just false.
Oh, no. They're doing their basic. They won't go above and beyond that. My domain registrar has rung me up to say, do you know you're behind?
Oh, no, like, that's oh, not actually, practical no, to have them call me on the phone. There's, you know, hundreds and hundreds of thousands.
Not for $3 a month, I suppose. But it is practical when you pay the full economic rate.
Yeah, I don't know. I think them sending me three emails, if I'm not watching my email, that's my problem. That's not somebody being a vulture and you know, trying to make it that they're trying to get me to not renew. If they send me three notices...
Well, I'm not saying they're trying to, but they have an interest in you not. So they're not going to try as hard as someone who doesn't have that same interest.
Yeah, totally disagree. Totally disagree. I think sending three notes is not, I mean, that's the most I could expect.
It's reasonable. I'll grant you that. But it's not, you're not going to get any more than reasonable. Whereas in my case, if I don't renew, they lose money. Whereas if you don't renew, they could make money.
Why do I need more than reasonable? I think you're accusing them of something that's you're putting them down in a way that's not true. I mean,
well, there is a guy. I can't remember the name of the project now. It was a big open source project, a security related one, and he had the name of that project .org or something, and he had changed his email address and he hadn't noticed for a couple of weeks that his domain was gone. So he came back a little late and he went, ah, sugar, I've just realized I haven't paid you. And they went, I'm sorry, we just auctioned it off. And basically he was then subject to extortion and they were looking for literally, I think it was $5,000, the guy who won the domain at auction, to give him his domain back.
Okay, so wait a minute.
So domain squatters are basically being...
He changed his email address, didn't notify his domain name registrar. He didn't even look at his website for a couple of weeks. He didn't really
What the guy did who bought it was he mirrored the site so it didn't look any different and then basically started demanding thousands of dollars to get control.
Okay, that sounds completely his fault. You can't blame GoDaddy for that.
Yeah, it is his fault. I'll grant you it's his fault, but at the same time, I know that wouldn't have happened with my registrar because my registrar isn't going to sell it off to the highest bidder the moment I make a mistake. He had to make a mistake first, definitely.
Right, and ignore three notices and, you know, offers to do it cheaper if you did it early. I mean, I don't know. Well, let's move on to another bit. One of the things that I do like about GoDaddy from a hosting service perspective is I've got 24-hour tech support. I mean, I can call them on the phone. They answer quickly. They have usually known what they're talking about 9 times out of 10. They've given me help. I've sent them emails. They respond to me very, very quickly on that. And the weirdest thing is I've gotten phone calls back on two separate occasions from supervisors saying, hey, did you get the help you needed? How was the service that you got? That's
I've had
from
very
a
different
$10 a year. Well, you don't have hosting service with GoDaddy.
I do, actually. I don't have personal hosting with GoDaddy, but I manage a GoDaddy server for a customer.
Okay.
It's not the same $10 package you're on. It's actually a more expensive package.
Wait, I'm not on a $10 package. We were $10 was the domain.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Okay, I'm getting a little ahead of ourselves. But anyway, perhaps we should pull back a moment. So that's sort of the domain registration. You're paying for your domain to exist on the internet, and the person who's doing it for you has control, so I would advise it be someone you trust. And if you want to get it for dirt cheap, you know, go with GoDaddy, but know that if you make a mistake, it's gone.
Okay, yeah,
whereas
know that if you ignore three requests to have it renewed, it'll be gone.
You know, you change your email and you forget. It's quite a normal. I mean, you don't think of these things when you change email address. I think of lots of things, but I don't think of GoDaddy, to be honest. It can happen. You know, yeah, it's your fault, but it can happen. Whereas if you pay a little more, you'll end up with a registrar that's possibly quite a bit more forgiving and accommodating.
You may have found one registrar in the universe who would call you on the phone. I don't believe that there's going to be other registrars who do that, by the way.
And it's possible, but it's a local business, so I guess they have an interest in keeping local customers happy.
Yeah.
There's a lot to be said for local business. You know, the corner store has a lot of advantages, but you pay a little more for it, so I'm paying a few extra dollars a year.
But I don't mind that.
It's half the price
of
a beer.
But it sounds a little bit like a mom-and-pop shop, which can disappear pretty easily, too.
No, I visited their data center. It's far from a mom-and-pop shop. It's huge. They're the leading Irish IT company, actually, or hosting registration company, etc. They're the biggest in Ireland.
Okay.
And they have impressive infrastructure.
Okay, so anyway, we were talking about hosting now.
Yes, so the next step, of course, is, you know, you have a domain and it has DNS which can point it at a server, which will hold your actual physical web page. So you now need to go buy a server to hold your actual physical web page, because otherwise you haven't really gotten anywhere yet. So that's hosting. And you kind of have three options. And, you know, they go from, at the cheapest end, your, what is it, $3 a year? Or no, not $3 a year.
It's
that's
like $3 a month.
$3 a month or something.
Right.
What is it?
Yeah, it's about $3 a month at GoDaddy.
About $3 a month. Up to, if you really want to go mad, you can easily find someone who will take $10,000 a month off you for a really high-end hosting. So, you know, in between, you have pretty much everything. But it falls into three basic categories, I guess. On the lowest end, you have shared hosting, which is what you'll get for your $3 a month. And when you'll get that for more as well, if you need more bandwidth, more disk space, and so forth. But the basic idea is they have a giant big server. Well, they probably have many giant big servers. And they simply put lots and lots of people on the one server. And you share that server with up to a couple of thousand people. Maybe a few hundred, possibly a few thousand, depending on the size of the server and the size of the company. And most of the time, that works fine. But it does come with drawbacks. So there's a reason it's cheap, because it's much, much easier for the hosting company to do that.
Right.
There was another. It's easy for them. It's cheap for you.
Another thing you pointed out to me when I first got my shared hosting with GoDaddy was they really limit what you can do in terms of, like, I can't SSH into my server or anything like that. I have much more limited privileges than if I had a dedicated host.
Oh, massively so. But it's not. Yeah. So you have to use their infrastructure. So if they have decided that they want you to use FTP, despite the fact that FTP is a decades out of date protocol that sends all of your passwords and all of your data in plain text and has absolutely no place in the modern world, they still use it. So
right.
You have to use it and you have no choice,
right.
Which is annoying. It drives me mad. How anyone can use FTP in this day and age is just insanity. But there you go. It's the done thing. And it has been the done thing for years. And it will probably be the done thing for years. But anyway, I think I'm getting distracted by one of my pet hates there. So they control the server, they control the operating system, and they control what software is available to you. Now, they generally do a pretty good job. They give you Apache as a web server generally, which is pretty damn good. And there's also an option of having Windows hosting, which costs a little more because they have to pay licensing.
Oh, sorry.
I know. I don't know
just
why you'd want to.
Hairball
some people
there for
like writing ASP pages and stuff. And they need a Windows host. And they have to pay more for licensing, whereas Apache is free, so it's cheaper hosting still. So they will put Apache on it. They usually put PHP on it. Usually, if they're a good host, they'll even give you the choice of PHP 4 or PHP 5. Which is, actually, I'd say I'm impressed with how GoDaddy do that. They basically let you configure the server configurations per domain. So you can say, yeah, I want to be PHP 5, whereas someone else sharing the same physical server gets to be a PHP 4 if they like. And that's actually very nice, and they've done that well.
Yeah, that was one of the points where I wanted to enable TwitPic for my website so that you'd be able to use, or not TwitPic, sorry, PicLens. And I couldn't do it because it said it was an older version of PHP. And you said, oh, my God, you got to get them to get you onto another server. And I wrote to them and they said, oh, just do this and it'll switch you over, which I haven't done yet.
Yeah. Oh, tut tut. Okay. No, they have a nice architecture in place for that. I'm impressed with them for that, I have to say. But there is still a limit to what they can do, because PHP has a million and one different ways it can be configured. And, you know, they can't have every single option available to every single person because they're not running that many instances of PHP. So it all gets a bit messy. And at the end, there will come a point when you will be told that you have to have a certain graphics library in place to do something. And the reality is, they probably don't have that graphics library, or they have a different version of that graphics library, and they can't change it for you because then someone else will complain. And you basically, you have to take what you're given. They will offer you some options if they can, but in general, you have to take what you're given. And, you know, that's quite reasonable for the money you're paying. You can't expect any more than that for that sort of very small amounts of money. So in the past, then, you only had one other step, which was to go dedicated. So you had either shared or dedicated. And dedicated means that somewhere in some data center in the far-off internet, there is a physical machine that is yours and yours alone. You don't own it, you rent it, but it's yours. You control the operating system. You ask them, please install the latest version of FreeBSD or the latest version of CentOS or the latest version of Windows, God help you. You know, you decide what OS is going to go on it. They install it for you, and then they hand over the virtual keys, and it's yours.
Now, that isn't always fail-safe. I mean, I think we all noticed that Leo Laporte has full dedicated hosting, and he lost everything on a couple of his sites just this week.
Yeah, I mean, if you take the reins, with great power comes great responsibility. You are then responsible for looking after your operating system. You are responsible for updating your operating system. You are responsible for updating PHP. You are responsible for updating Apache. But you also get the choice to install anything you like.
Right, but it was the RAID 5 server the RAID 5 that went down and marked all of the disks as though they were bad.
That kind of thing can happen
anywhere,
shared,
right?
Dedicated as well. It can happen anywhere. Now, in theory, on shared hosting, they should have a backup. So I've had shared hosting go down for a couple of hours while they restored from a backup, and then everything was fine again. It happens. It can happen anywhere because physical hardware fails. If you're running your own server, though, you have one more responsibility that you hand over to your provider if you take shared. That is, you have to do your own backups. And that's where Leo went down, because Leo did not have an up-to-date backup.
Yeah, that's kind of interesting. I mean, I'm not the smartest, sharpest knife in the drawer here, and I do my own backups.
Yeah. I have a nightly script that runs on my servers and synchronizes, it uses rsync, and it basically copies, all my servers copy to each other. So unless all of my servers get destroyed at the same time, I'm fine. It's a sort of cheapskate way of doing it, because in theory I could pay a little bit of extra and get backup space, but why pay extra when you have more than one server? Just, you know, server one backs up to server two, and server two backs up to server one. That's a little bit of cheating I do. But anyway, you have to look after it. It's your problem.
Okay.
But the flip side is lots of power.
But how expensive is that?
Actually, you would think it would be insanely expensive, but it starts off very reasonable. What I'm now, my new server I'm just in the process of signing all the paperwork for, is a Celeron server, a couple of gigahertz. It has a gigabyte of RAM, 200 gigabyte hard disk, and a 10 megabit always-on network connection. And that's costing me $69 a month if I pay monthly, and it would be as little as $51 a month if I paid biannually, which I'm not going to do.
That's $840 a year. That's a lot of money. I'd have to be making money off that server.
Or be as big a nerd as me. I was paying more for my current dead server. For me, that is worth a fortune. I make money doing webby stuff for people. I think my network presence, my internet presence is very important. And I get very, very frustrated on shared hosting.
Okay.
Really frustrated really quickly. So for me, $69 a month is exceptionally reasonable. In fact, the company I'm with, they're a Canadian crowd called iWeb8. They actually, I was very tempted. It's even more expensive, but I didn't do it. But as a Mac user, I was interested by a tab. I went for the tab that said cheapest hosting, which is where I got this. So I could go much higher. But there was a tab that said Mac hosting. And for $499 a month, you can have an Xserve. Or, more reasonably, for $99 a month, you can have a Mac Mini.
$99 a month, huh? But you didn't do it.
I didn't do it, no. I don't. I think Macs are a terrible server platform because of Apple's terrible record of security. So I wouldn't actually run any sort of Mac as a server. I think that's asking for trouble. I wouldn't do it. I always run Linux servers because they're patched far, far quicker.
Sure. All right, now, you were going to say there's a third way.
There's
to
an in-betweeny, yes. There's a halfway house these days. It's a new thing, and it's thanks to VMware and its ilk. So now you can have a virtual dedicated server. So, you know, you're still sharing the physical hardware with a few other people, but obviously far less. But each of you gets their own VM. So there's basically, you know, 50 instances of Linux running, and each of you get one.
Sure,
so
that can
you
be
have
very
control
effective.
Of the operating system. It can be very effective. So you get complete control of the operating system and the software just like you would with dedicated, but it's cheaper because they don't have to give you a whole machine. So on GoDaddy, you can get a virtual dedicated server for $27 a month.
Hmm.
That's a lot more reasonable. It's half the price, a little less, in fact.
Now, remember, when you're a virtual dedicated server versus a dedicated server, though, you've also got significant network limitations, because all of those 50 virtual servers are using the same NIC cards. You may have up to like four on a pretty hefty server.
Yeah, and these machines are generally slightly oversold because no one uses all of their allotted CPU all of the time. It's like DSL broadband. They sell 500 people a 1 megabit connection or whatever. They don't have 500 megabits there. They might have 200 megabits,
right.
But they know that no one's on all at the same time.
Right, but so I was just saying it is a big difference, though, between dedicated and virtual dedicated is going to be the network bandwidth.
Not just that, also CPU. If you're on with some people who are particularly big hogs, you may find that you're not getting the full CPU you'd like.
Sure.
If there's some sort of a denial of service attack against one of your colleagues, one of your sharees, you're going to suffer too, because you're on the one server.
Right.
You know, you're a bigger target for DDoS. If someone else who's sharing with you annoys someone and they get DDoSed, you get DDoSed too.
Right.
So there's definitely disadvantages, but it's a halfway house. You get almost all the advantages of dedicated, but not quite all.
And how much did you say that was?
$27 is what I'm paying on GoDaddy for that.
That's
not bad. It's not for me personally. It's for a client. But yeah, it's not bad. Now, that comes with another warning, because technically it's an advantage of virtual dedicated. If you have a physical dedicated server and it becomes too small because you've become Leo Laporte and you're suddenly really popular, you have to physically upgrade that machine, which involves someone in the data center flipping it up and sticking in more RAM, sticking in a new hard drive, or maybe simply giving you a whole new server because you suddenly need 8 CPUs and you only have one. You know, there's no room for 8 in the physical server you have now. That's a big deal. With virtual dedicated, they just type in and say, that virtual machine now has so much megahertz and so much RAM. Hey, presto, done. So that's definitely an advantage, but it comes with a slight disadvantage. In true GoDaddy style, they always try to upsell you. It's their thing. I mean, you know, you like GoDaddy, but you have to admit, every millimeter that they can possibly use to advertise at you, they will.
Oh my! Okay, I do have to do a rant there, Bart. Is the thing that drives me crazy about GoDaddy is when you do have to interact on their website. In fact, maybe I'll put a screenshot into the show notes to show how little of the screen real estate is dedicated to the question you actually want to have, like log in versus advertising something else you can do. I mean, it's like 99%, and I get to see Danica Patrick showing her assets.
Well, I think,
to us.
Thingy, what's his face? Cranky Geek himself is absolutely obsessed with Dana.
Yeah.
Or Danica, whatever her name is. Every single time that ad is on, he says, you know, can we have her on the show?
But, you know, I mean, I hear she's brilliant and everything, and that's wonderful, but I just don't need to look at her half dressed as much as apparently they think I do. But anyway, rant off.
Yeah, so, you know, they certainly try to upsell you, and when you get their cheapest virtual dedicated, they run a control panel by default, and it's a huge monolithic thing written in Java. It's insanely inefficient. It runs an entire web server just for itself. And basically, because you have a pretty small virtual machine, that control panel takes up most of your resources. And so you run a blog or something, it gets a few hits, and suddenly your machine isn't big enough anymore. And you ring support, and their answer is, you have to upgrade. Whereas the simpler answer, which I've discovered, is turn off the sodding control panel.
Can you do that?
Yeah, you have complete control of the operating system.
Oh,
it's a virtual dedicated server.
Okay.
So it's a service. It has a name. You just say service bloody blah stop. Hmm. It's gone. Poof. Bye.
Interesting.
Yes. So that's a little trick. And I Googled for it on the web. I think there's a link there. Well, there would be a link to it on my blog if my blog existed. But it's a few very simple commands and it just turns that off. And all of a sudden, all of those resources become free. And you can actually do a lot on the $27 a month small itty bitty virtual server. So it's not a bad option if you're prepared to do that kind of thing. Something which I worry about. Now, some people think I'm mad. Quite a few people think I'm mad.
Really? I'm shocked anybody would think that.
Yeah, it's not an unknown thing. But I actually care which political jurisdiction my server is in. Because the laws that apply to your server are the laws of the jurisdiction it's in. I'm with a Canadian company because I don't want my server in America. I don't, the Patriot Act, all that kind of carry on, I want nothing to do with it, and I don't want the FBI and AT&T illegally spying on my shit. It, you know, not happening. So I keep my stuff in Canada. Some people care about these things, some people don't.
Why don't you keep them in Ireland?
Well, I did for a very long time, but it's cheaper to go to Canada. especially with the current exchange rates, because I get to pay in American dollars, which from a euro point of view now is fantastic.
Shut up.
Yeah, don't buy anything in euros, you guys. That's not wise.
Oh, don't get me started on it.
But yeah, so for me, I wanted to keep it in Ireland, but the reality is I'm paying 10% less for 50% more by going to Canada.
Wow.
And, you know, do the math.
So I think one of the things you wanted to push was that whatever your political persuasion is, it is important to know that the laws of that country where it's hosted will determine what law enforcement can do or cannot do.
Yeah, exactly. You probably know the laws of your own country. What you are probably not as well aware of the laws of other countries. And if you think, you're thinking, your mindset is going to be the laws of your country. So you will make these assumptions as to what is the reality of the legalities. And those assumptions could be completely wrong.
You mean like the Canadian law that says that as you go through customs that they can pull your iPod and your computer and take everything off of it if you want, that the Canadians can do that? You mean things like that?
I find that's an American law, actually.
No, there's both. Don't.
Just both.
It is both ways. Right. But that's a Canadian law that you can do that.
Yeah, exactly. You just need to be aware of the different jurisdictions. Now, I don't plan on ever physically visiting my server, so my iPod ain't going to enter into the equation. I'm just interested in, you know, if someone accuses me of libel or whatever, can they get an injunction against me? How will they go about that? How easy would it be for them? You know, how much evidence is needed before someone can seize my server? Is there a burden of proof at all, or is it just someone says the word and suddenly the Secret Service swoop in and take it?
Well, now,
I mean,
now,
I certainly wouldn't want to host in Russia or, you know, some other countries. I'm not saying that's what would happen in America. But
well,
I'm just saying
you
need to be aware.
How do you know what the Canadian laws are, though? How do you know what those laws are?
A little bit of RTFMing. I sort of
RTFM?
Watch these things. Read the fine manual.
So you read the Canadian laws?
No, I just read websites by people who claim to know what they're talking about. You have to take these things on faith. You can get too carried away.
I just think a lot of times we get a lot of flack and we're very, very visible, but there might be countries that are just a little quieter than we are and you might not know what the laws are. I mean, if I do one and it's in
UK.
England, I don't know how I would know.
Yeah, the UK, for example, has some really nasty laws and no one seems to make a big deal about them, but they're just every bit as nasty as American laws, only they get away with it and they seem to be friendlier or something, I don't know. No one ever seems to take anything maliciously when the British do it.
Except for all those video
cameras.
The
mind. But yeah, but that's not really a big deal in most places. That goes totally unnoticed. I mean, places have insane powers to stop and search you and all sorts of stuff over in the UK, and it mostly goes unnoticed. So, you know, whereas in America, everyone makes a big deal out of it. So, you know, just because you don't hear much about it on the news doesn't mean it all is okay, I suppose.
Exactly.
But anyway, I like you say, we don't really want to go into too much politics here. The point is, be aware that where your server is matters. If you're American and you know American law, it's probably easier to keep your server in America. And as it happens, America is a first world country with massive amounts of infrastructure, so it's quite easy to do. As a European, you know, the European Union have some pretty nice laws. Ideally speaking, I'd actually like to keep it within the EU, but in this case, pure money has dictated that Canada's a good choice.
Well, I'm going to cut us off here because we've been going on for quite a long time here, way past our regular limit. So the bottom line here is that we wanted to make sure you understood the difference between domain registration and hosting, and also to go over that there are three types of hosting: your shared hosting, your dedicated hosting that's really expensive, and the middle ground with virtual dedicated servers. And I think you did a good job of explaining all that to us, Bart.
Okay, and I guess the key point is don't go for dedicated or virtual dedicated if you don't know what you're doing, because you'll be hacked in a week. I'm not joking. You know, do that one. You know what you're getting into on that one.
Right. Okay. We got to stop, Bart.
Yes, I'm stopping.
All right. Well, I think we're all plans to be on the air again next week.
I certainly plan to. So until then, happy computing.
Well, it's time to say goodbye, I'm afraid. This has to come to an end. But don't worry, I'll be back with another episode of the NoSillaCast with stories of old ladies on TV talk shows, auto repair ads that include references to teeth cleaning, and tools that help you organize your life and understand what they have to do with time travel. If you'd like to be a part of the show, send in your audio recordings to NoSillaCast@gmail.com. Or if you'd like to just send me compliments about the show, I'll take those too. Heck, you can even write me and say, "Hey, Bonehead, everybody knows you can boot from an external USB drive now. All I care is that you do write." And be sure to check out the live show over at ustream.tv/nosillacast around 5 p.m. GMT minus 8 on Sunday nights. And don't forget to follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/podfeet. Thanks for listening and stay subscribed.